This is the Coast 89.7 Weekly News Magazine, Dialogue, highlighting local news stories and events in our Cape Breton communities.
Hello and welcome back to Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. I'm Bill McCush. This week, a Cape Breton-born radio announcer now living down under talks about how Australia is among the best in the world in keeping COVID-19 under control. Also, we'll hear from the Canadian Mental Health Association for tips and suggestions on how to deal with isolation and frustration that comes with staying away from friends and family. And a familiar voice on Dialogue, Paul McDougall, is on the other side of the mic this time to share his knowledge on viruses, how they work, and the best way to protect ourselves from getting infected. These stories are coming up on Dialogue. The Canadian Mental Health Association's Elizabeth Baker says most people are frustrated and stressed out over COVID-19, but she says it's okay and it's normal to feel that way. She says it's important to keep your mind and body healthy as communities and health officials weather the storm of the virus. She offers some suggestions and reminders on how to best deal with the pandemic.
CMHA is we're not a community-based organization. We are a national association, so you know you could go across Canada and see the CMHAs in different provinces. Each province is a little bit different, so there are kind of different services that are available depending on where you go in the country. Within Nova Scotia, so yeah, as I mentioned, there's kind of our education and training programming. We have a housing support program, so that's Project HOPE, support individuals finding, you know, secure housing. There's peer support programs. We do a fair bit of suicide prevention work. We have an at-work program, which similarly supports individuals in finding meaningful employment. I actually worked in that position before shifting over to education, so it took a little while for me to get around to education with CMHA, but that is certainly where kind of our heart lies. But there's a couple different resources and services that are offered, you know, here in Nova Scotia.
Are you hearing a lot of concerns from people who are struggling with pandemic measures, such as isolation or not being able to see their loved ones and friends?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, no, that has certainly been, you know, mental health kind of been brought to the forefront in the past year. And I think there's a lot of different concerns around that, you know, the duration, for one thing, right? You know, when this kind of started, you know, the beginning of last year, I don't think many of us anticipated it lasting quite as long. So it's hard to, you know, stay motivated and engaged, and there's concern around vaccinations and different isolation requirements. So the thing, you know, that people are talking more about mental health and sharing when they're struggling, which for me is important. And I think what makes, you know, COVID-19 so unique is normally when we go through trauma or crisis, what supports us with getting through that is connection, right? We kind of lean into one another and look to support one another. And the problem with COVID-19 is obviously the solution a little bit, or what would alleviate that pandemic, is to kind of break up some of that connection. So we've had to find different ways of connecting and shifting our resources on ways to do that when we're going through these hard times. So I think that's certainly been something that's come up is, you know, it's hard to really replicate being with someone in person. I think that's been what's hard, is going through these hard times too and not being able to really connect the way that we normally would.
What is some good advice for people who are feeling maybe a little bit hopeless or worried about getting sick? Surely there's a wide range of emotions out there for people.
Yeah, no, for sure. So, and I think that's something that, you know, when we're looking at worry and anxiety around COVID-19, I think one of the most important things is just to examine what you can control. You know, you can imagine and picture kind of the worst of everything, but really you can only adjust what you're able to and what you have that control over. There are lots of recommendations out there, you know, follow the Nova Scotia Health recommendations, take the precautions that you feel are necessary in terms of, you know, mask, hand sanitizing, staying home. But if you're beyond that, you know, if you're still feeling a lot of anxiety around that, you know, take some time to think, examine some of those thoughts and think, okay, is this something that I'm able to control? And if so, what are some of the kind of steps I could do to support that? You know, if it's shopping online as much as you can, or just recognizing that, you know, there's a lot of stress that can come and worry from things that we can't control. So just making sure that when we're looking at that, it's something that we're able to. I know for myself, you know, feeling hopeless and worried over the past year has been challenged. My biggest thing in the past year was gratitude. It's just kind of shifting that. You know, it's hard not to be caught up with the worry and the stress and the kind of negative things right now. So just, I would do a gratitude journal, right? And I'd write down things that I was grateful for, just looking for the good and shifting that perspective.
So it is normal to feel discouraged at a time like this. So if someone's feeling that way, they should know they're not alone.
Absolutely. You know, each of us, we all have mental health. And we're all going to move up and down kind of that continuum of how we're feeling. It's very natural and expected to have hard times and life stressors. And just, you know, similar to our physical health, right, where we have times where we're feeling well and times where we're not feeling as good. And I think what's important is when you're feeling discouraged and when we're feeling down, thinking about how we support ourselves during this time, right? So how are you taking care of yourself? How do you connect still with your family or friends? And are you getting any exercise in? You know, we're very fortunate to still have, you know, good access to the outdoors right now. And nature, you know, nature can do some wonders for you. So just making sure that when you're feeling down, you're resting and eating well and getting the supports, really, that kind of can help you build that resilience during this time.
You know, you mentioned exercising there and being in a place like Nova Scotia and in Cape Breton here, there are a lot of places where people can go to enjoy the outdoors within their own municipality. And I'm just wondering if you can talk about the relationship between physical health and mental health.
Yeah, no, they're very, very much correlated. So when we're feeling down, and it's kind of, we're looking at our physical state and emotional and mental state, they all really kind of feed into one another. When looking at mental health, if you're not feeling well physically and you're not able to do certain things, your mental health is impacted. Just going for a 10-minute walk and getting some fresh air, doing some breathing, and just, you know, stepping up and getting some movement in does boost your serotonin, dopamine, and you know, which are your kind of feel-good chemicals, and it supports your mental health. They're you know, directly correlated.
Can we talk about social media for a moment? Sometimes people can be discouraged with, you know, there's often a lot of drama and negative discussion often posted online. And meanwhile, do you think it's also a place to find a positive distraction?
Mm-hmm, yeah. So social media, you know, it can be an excellent tool and I believe really has been, you know, a phenomenal tool in the past year for allowing individuals to stay connected and stay engaged. You know, as you mentioned, social media certainly has its kind of pros and cons. As much as it allows you to stay engaged, you know, it's kind of also a constant reminder of what we are experiencing and going through. And social media kind of invites us to be comparing ourselves to others. So if you're struggling or you're not feeling very well and, you know, you go on social media and you see how great someone else might be doing or what they're sharing, that often can make you feel a bit worse or carry guilt or shame, thinking, you know, why can't I do that right now? Why aren't I feeling that good? So it's just important to remember that social media can be filled with some kind of false images and expectations. And we don't really know kind of other people's, their unique experiences. So just making sure that when we're on social media, we're thinking of that. And, you know, for myself, I think it's so essential to just maybe not limit, but just be quite aware of your exposure, constant exposure to, you know, as you kind of mentioned, the negative discussions and drama that can be present on social media can sometimes be quite overwhelming. And just making sure that when we're looking up to find resources and supports to navigate through this and update our information around COVID-19, to make sure that we're using reputable sources. A lot of individuals on social media may believe some of the things that they see, but just making sure that when we're looking at it, you know, we're finding some reputable sources to make sure that the information we're receiving and kind of, you know, filling our thoughts with is accurate, and ensure that we're kind of getting that up-to-date information.
Do you hear many stories of people using their isolation time wisely with hobbies or learning something new, or maybe they had a project they were looking to get around to? Is that some good advice for people, and do you hear about things like that?
Mm-hmm, yes. That, you know, there is a plus with COVID-19. The amount of things that have been put on online now for us to be able to take advantage of and participate in is pretty phenomenal. I've heard lots of people who are doing, you know, online educational courses that are being offered free or following YouTube tutorials to learn a new hobby. And when we're learning kind of those new skills, you know, it can boost our confidence and self-esteem, and all those are going to support our mental health and support our resilience through this. I do think it's something also, you know, when we're thinking about being productive and we do perhaps have more time on our hands, if, you know, particularly for isolating to do some of those those kind of, you know, jobs you often put off to the side when you've got more things on the go. But it's also important to recognize that, you know, we are living through quite a challenging time right now, and it certainly is okay to not be okay, right? To not be the most productive right now. So just making sure that we're also, as much as that, those opportunities are there, you know, being kind to ourselves, to have some forgiveness and compassion to how we're feeling. You know, perhaps today wasn't your most productive day, and that's okay. Then maybe that's what you needed today to support yourself, right? So just recognizing that kind of each day is a new day for different opportunities that way.
What about for the people experiencing financial struggles because of reduced hours? And what suggestions or advice do you think people should have when they're dealing with issues like that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So stress for finances, you know, can cause some great anxiety and worries. We're certainly hearing a lot of that kind of in the past years of the stress of that. And also just, again, the kind of duration of it, right? Those who, you know, perhaps are struggling didn't anticipate to have the same kind of financial struggles now. But so financial efficacy is confidence in managing your own money. So it doesn't necessarily depend on how much you have or what you have, just making sure that you're confident in how much you can manage and managing your own. So, you know, I'm going to say, of course, it's a good time to look at budgeting. And that's not necessarily, you know, breaking down everything to a T, but just, you know, making sure that you're aware of how much money is coming in, but then also, and, you know, perhaps more importantly, aware of how much money is going out and just conscious of where it's going. You know, perhaps during this time, you might be able to find some areas that you can cut back for a little bit and just kind of shift some of that. There are also plenty of financial supports out there. You know, I know there was the CERB and some different tax rebates. And I think, though, if you're accessing financial supports, just make sure that you know, everyone's informed of the details and information connected to those benefits and supports before really engaging with them. And ultimately, you know, ask for help with finances. I think often we tend to shy away from having conversations around finances, which I think makes people often feel, I know for myself, when I just, you know, more hesitant to engage in those conversations and bring it to the forefront. Often we feel uncomfortable talking about our own personal finances. But when talking to someone about, you know, help and managing through those finances, it's not a sign of weakness to ask for help. You know, I see it quite the opposite, actually. I feel it's taking responsibility, right, and building that confidence in managing your own money by asking someone else to help you, you know, navigate through and discuss it.
A lot of people are certainly upset and they miss their loved ones and friends. They can't see them. What about for some of the people out there that are, I guess, a lack of a better word, forced to spend more time with people? And you can, times like that, you know, you can find out, you can learn a lot about yourself and learn a lot about the people that you love and spend time with. But what happens when a certain level of frustration or stress comes between people when they're forced to spend more time together?
So I think with that, you breathe, you know, take a breath. It's quite hard because, you know, we can say take a break, and often when we take a breath and have some space, those kind of heated emotions or whatever frustrations that are there have an opportunity to kind of settle a little bit, and we come out of the emotional area of our brain and start thinking more around the logistic, the frontal lobe, and speak more of, okay, well, you know, why am I upset? Is it something about, you know, that they did specifically? Is it that I'm stuck in the situation? So it's harder when we're stuck in the same household and we're kind of on top of one another, you know, with not as much space. But just, you know, building in some routine, creating different activities that you can do with your family or partners, or just finding different ways of kind of entertaining yourself, and also making sure that you have a balance as much as you can of your own time, right? Do something that necessarily isn't together, and just also the other big thing for myself, and, you know, my partner can attest to this, communication. So if I'm not having a good day or I'm feeling frustrated and I'm just feeling down that day, you know, it's I don't always expect, you know, my partner to know that exactly. So I think often we just making sure that we're communicating with one another and say, hey, like, today's a rough day for me. And then, you know, equally, if someone says that to you, try to respect and give them a bit more space, because often it's a lot harder to do without being able to just take those kind of natural breaks and routines that come into our life. And, you know, especially I hear a lot of, you know, both parents working at home and families and students at home, and you know, it's a pretty hectic environment. So trying to find some routine and breaks when you can is essential.
Okay, so we had Elizabeth Baker on the line. She's with the Canadian Mental Health Association, sharing some tips and advice on helping people weather the storm of COVID-19. Elizabeth, thanks so much for your time today, and good luck to you.
Thank you very much. I want to appreciate the time that you've committed towards talking about this. It's a great topic, so I appreciate that.
Paul McDougall is a familiar voice on the coast. You'll hear him on The Good Sentence, where he and his guests talk about everything local, from books to music to folklore and everything in between. He also works at Cape Breton University, where he's a senior instructor in the Health Sciences Department. And today he's going to talk about COVID-19, the variants, and his thoughts on the effectiveness of vaccines.
Viruses in general, over time, can change or mutate. So this is a common occurrence in viruses as well as bacteria and other living things. And mutate basically means something has caused their genetic code, their DNA or RNA, which is the code that helps propagate the species and makes more organisms and everything. It's your template. Something along the line when a new organism is being made from a previous one, something changes. And that can be, mutations can happen on their own, like a 1 in a million chance of a mutation happening, but it can happen, or things like that. Or in some organisms, chemicals can cause a mutation to happen, radiation can cause mutations to happen. All kinds of things can do this. So when the coronavirus came about in basically December of 2019 is when we were first starting to get reports out of China about it, of this new illness. And then it didn't take very long to determine what kind of virus it was, because we have so many modern techniques now, electron microscopy and all kinds of molecular biological methods. It doesn't take too long to identify an organism if you can see it or detect it in some kind of a matrix. So within a few weeks, they knew it was a coronavirus. Coronavirus are a family of viruses, of which cold viruses are in. So we've all had coronaviruses before, and the other group is rhinoviruses. They also cause colds. So there's four or five coronaviruses that cause colds, and varying degrees of colds. Some aren't so bad, some are worse. Anyway, unfortunately, this coronavirus, became a lethal organism, easily transmittable. There's the jury is still out on where or how this kind of organism with such a, I call it nefarious, because we can carry it around. The asymptomatic people, they have no illness at all, and they can spread it, whereas other unfortunate people can get incredibly sick, maybe survive, and then they have illnesses that stay with them, or symptoms. They call them the long haulers. And then, of course, roughly 2% globally of people that get COVID die from it. And that's a fairly high death rate when you compare it to influenza, which is bad enough. But influenza, historically, year to year, is about 1 in 10,000, or 0.1%. So far, COVID now has killed 3.3 million people. So the thing with the variants people are discussing now, which my own gut feeling is in a couple of months, a few months' time, we won't even be discussing variants anymore. Variants means the organism has mutated. Something has changed somewhat and allowed it to become slightly different, the same, but slightly different. And what would happen in a situation like this, if you go back simply to evolution, it's survival of the fittest. So if some of the coronaviruses, when new ones are, the coronavirus infects human cells. When it gets in there, it makes more of itself. If some of those are mutating and creating a slightly different coronavirus, that because of the mutation, it can transmit easier, meaning it can get to other people and spread to them quicker than the original one, then it really only makes sense that over time or in due course, that variant, that one that's a little different, that transmits easier, is going to be the one that sticks around more. So what happened a number of months ago, we started to see what they call the variant, because again, this is easily done in the labs, molecular biology techniques, in that it's easy to look at the coronaviruses and figure out, oh, look, there's something slightly different about this one, and then this one, and this one, and this one. So over time, you start to see these are all the same, but they're all different from the original one. So that's the variant. So there was a UK variant, just named because it was first discovered or seen in the UK. Then there's a variant from India and a variant from Brazil. But I would say in a few months' time, all we're going to have is variant species from the original one, and then one of those may morph off into something else. So just have to assume now the coronavirus is what it is. It can change and mutate, and transmissibility is one of the key things. It can spread to others easier, and it appears with the variants, it's more problematic. The mortality, or the morbidity, sickness, and mortality, death is worse than the original. The same organism shifted somewhat and changed, so, but that's what it is. So thinking, is it the variant, is it the not variant? In a little while, none of that's going to be mattered, because there may be another variant come along. So it's just going to change and shift and mutate like influenza does in other viruses. Viruses are known for this to happen. The problem with this, of course, is it's what it's changing into is something that can spread around easier, which is the last thing you really wanted. That's why vaccination is so important now.
Is there a difference in how these vaccines were compared to ones that we've become used to in the past? And also, Paul, what about diseases and some illnesses that communities have dealt with in the past? They have been managed thanks to vaccines. How does COVID compare to things like the Spanish flu and polio, for example?
Yeah, those. Let's talk about those first. Those types of vaccines that were developed often. In the history of vaccines, vaccines really started to take off after the 1900s and the 1920s and 30s. And what you would be given as a vaccine would be a small dose of the actual organism, but it's been killed or attenuated is the term. Okay, so it could be something called a live attenuated vaccine. Different terminology, but what it is you're getting a small dose, small in the sense that it's not going to elicit the illness to happen in you, but it triggers your body's immune system. And there's many different types of cells in the body, but once they come in contact with something, a catch-all phrase is an antigen, they will then make antibodies for it. So if you stimulate your immune system with a live attenuated virus of some kind, the body will fight that, and then what happens is your body remembers it. Some cells in your body, antibody cells, become known as memory cells, and there's T cells that are killer cells. There's all kinds of them, and some of these will remember. So when you come in contact with the actual organism, what happens is you're ready to go, and your body can then ramp up and make they make more of the cells that you need, and the cells make more antibodies. So it's like being prepared. An enemy is coming, and you're at the fortress, and you've got, all your pots with hot oil already on the top, ready to dump down on top of them. That's really what vaccines are. They prepare you. Now, over the decades, we've literally been able to wipe out some of the worst scourges we've ever had from bacterial and viral illnesses through the use of vaccines. So one example this kind of goes back two generations with me. My grandmother came from Italy in the 30s, and my mother was born in prior to the 30s, late 1920s. My mother was born in 1930, and she remembers my grandmother always getting worried when my mother would have a cough because she would say, "Oh my God, I hope it's not the diphtheria." So into the 30s, diphtheria vaccine became developed. Prior to that, diphtheria, a disease that almost nobody, you mentioned that to someone in their 20s or 30s, they won't even know what you're talking about. Bacterial disease, attacks the respiratory system, makes this kind of membrane over your throat, you can't breathe, no treatment, and you die from it. Killed millions of people. The vaccine conked out diphtheria. It's still around in a few countries. Most part it's gone. Smallpox, that's a viral illness. Took 30 to 40 years of a global effort led by the World Health Organization to rid the world of smallpox. Same kind of idea. We can get rid of these. TB, everybody gets vaccinated against TB, but as an example, to put things in context, TB or tuberculosis, there's at least about 10 million people a year get TB. When COVID came along, some of these other illnesses we seem to forget about. Now, TB is a bacterial illness. If you get TB, if you're not vaccinated and you end up with TB, then you're on a suite of anti-tuberculosis drugs for 2 months. If that's not working, you might have to take another drug. In 2019, 1.4 million people died in 1 year, in 2019, latest numbers, from tuberculosis. So we've got 3.3 million deaths of COVID right now, worldwide, right? So if 1.4 million when the numbers for 2020 come out, there's 2.8 million in roughly the same time period of people dying from TB. And the people that are dying from TB are the ones in countries where the vaccination they haven't been able to get vaccinated. And these are more poor or less developed countries. In richer countries, and like where we live, you don't see so much or hear too much about TB. Everyone's vaccinated. Some indigenous communities in the north that never got TB vaccinated or properly or booster shots, they end up with TB. But that's a disease. The vaccine was developed 50, 60 years ago and probably needs a newer version of vaccine as well, because that one is becoming a little less effective because the TB itself is changing a bit. To make a long story short, all those kind of vaccines took a long time to develop. What happened with coronavirus was virologists, vaccinologists, and molecular biologists have been exploring the idea, instead of putting portions of viruses or bacteria or small segments of them into the body to stimulate the immune response, why not inject RNA, the code from the virus, part of the code, so that it will then stimulate your body to make something that looks like part of the virus. So when you hear a lot of the spike protein. So this is an attachment protein on the surface of coronavirus. That's why it's corona. Corona means star. Looks like a star under an electron microscope. Those are the spikes. And they attach the cells and then allow the virus to inject itself in. So these RNA viruses stimulate your body to make small amounts of spike protein, nothing else, just the spike protein. And then if you come in contact with corona, what happens is your body is primed for it, it's ready for it, and then it attacks it and kills it or doesn't allow it to go any further. So that's the key. So these are called messenger RNA. Messenger RNA is a type of RNA we humans carry. We have messenger RNA in all our cells, and that's what they're using. And the remarkable part about all that was in, like, January of 2020, the Chinese scientists had the genetic code all figured out of the coronavirus, because it's that kind of stuff isn't hard to do. You run it through you extract the organism from whatever specimen you have, run it through a machine, it's called a PCR machine, and then you sequence it and you know the sequence. Once you know the sequence, they actually had a vaccine developed in January 2020 in 3 days, the first version of a messenger RNA vaccine. and it had to be then refined and then go through all the clinical trials, three various sets of it, you know, with hundreds of people and then thousands and then greater numbers, right, to prove one safe and plus effective. So this is the future. One thing about all this is the future in my mind for vaccines with new or emerging illnesses and maybe older ones that haven't gone away yet. Malaria is another one, which is caused by a parasite. But we may be able to develop vaccines in the same manner, target certain parts on them, and if it's a new organism, a new virus, ramp it up much quicker. And the ramping up and the scale up is really about how you test to make sure it works. So traditionally, vaccines are done phase 1, 2, and 3, and you have to do them in order. But what happened now with Corona, they overlapped some of these phases. So the public health, science, medical community will be working on figuring out a way to speed that whole process up in time, because we have to be looking at the future. And that's a promising thing, because maybe, say, in 2024, there's another terrible virus. But maybe we'll have a vaccine developed, made, and be in production within 2 months instead of what it took this time, which was still only really 11 months, which is incredibly fast.
You know, Paul, I'd like to ask you, what about the time in between the first dose and the booster shot? You mentioned a very important point there when it comes down to choice. Medical professionals obviously saying, you know, it plays a big role in keeping the virus under control. So I'm glad you covered that. But yeah, what do you think of that first shot and then the booster shot?
Okay, so when the companies developed the vaccines, they had their, I believe Pfizer was second dose, 21 days later. I think Moderna was 28. The AstraZeneca was 21. They're all roughly in that. And the new one that's recently been approved, the Johnson & Johnson, that's just the one shot, I understand. But we're not getting that in Canada yet, but we will. But the other ones, between 21 and 28 days. The reason the medical people and governments wanted to push that longer was due to the limited supply. If say Canada had 30 or 40 million vaccines that showed up say 2 months ago, then they could have just said, okay, everyone's going to get it, and then in 3 weeks you're going to get your second dose. So there was a lot of discussion in that through the medical community, and there's been the general consensus was, yeah, we can let it go longer. Because think of it this way. When you get your first dose, it gives you, after a couple of weeks, it gives you, say, a certain level of immunity, which is way better than what you had before the vaccine. So if you're up starting to reach, like, a peak of your immunity, the second dose is what puts you over the top with that. Okay, so it's not like anyone with a first dose is not got some protection. You have a lot of protection. You have more, probably more than 60% protection for most of these vaccines. So if you get your second dose, it's higher. So I can understand why they went for the longer time period. Now, that it's possible that, let's take Canada, for example, if we start getting more and more people vaccinated and more vaccines coming into Canada, maybe that time period might eventually be, maybe it will be shortened. Who knows? That's the governments will decide that. But it's all a matter of supply and demand. Now, the interesting thing about the AstraZeneca vaccine, because there's the issue of the blood clots and that, and I think most people know that now, most provinces have stopped giving that as the first dose, unless you've already had it. And again, the risk of that blood clot is, for most people, less than it is if you flew on an airplane. But anyway, aside from that, there's a study going on in the UK now that should be out in very early June, which is going to compare that vaccine, if you got it as your first dose, and getting Pfizer as your second dose. And there's actually preliminary results have already shown that as far as side effects or anything like that, untoward events happening, by getting the second different one. It's not much difference. There is a degree higher amount of fever after you get the vaccine. But to me, if you get a fever for a day or so or after a vaccine, all that's telling you is your vaccine is working. And so we'll know that in a couple of weeks' time. It's probably going to come out and say, yes, do that. And so everybody that got the AstraZeneca will then get the new messenger RNA one. And you get two different types of vaccines, a more traditional one, and then the newer molecular biology-based one. And it could even be possible that the combination of the two might be even better than having two shots of the same. And then just one other point on AstraZeneca, when they decided on going to 12 weeks with that in the UK, a study did come out which showed some evidence that if you delay it to 6 weeks, it might be better to actually delay it to 12 weeks because the vaccine efficacy at 12 weeks was actually a little better than if you gave it to people after 6 weeks. So there's a lot of things to consider and to know, and scientists in the medical community are learning it, where all this is evolving and could be changing. And when you hear critics complaining about this, that, and the other thing, you wonder, well, like, you know, have you ever spent the time in the lab? You know, have you ever tried to do any of this work under this intense pressure? And, you know, all the people that work in labs, you know, they're gowned up and masks on and gloves and then you know, face shields and everything, and you're doing all this kind of work. It's a little ludicrous when you hear criticisms of how come it's taking so long to figure this out or that out or whatever, or why did you change? Well, we changed because we learned more about what's going on with the illness.
Thanks, Paul. I wish we had more time to talk about this. That's some very good information you're sharing. And on the line, we have a senior instructor in the Health Sciences Department at CBU, Paul McDougall, talking about COVID-19, the variants, and how we can best protect ourselves throughout this pandemic. Paul, thanks so much for your time. That was very interesting and okay. very valuable information. I really appreciate that.
Great. Thank you very much, Bill, and stay well.
Ron Young started on local radio back in the 90s at a young age, and his passion for radio took him from downtown Sydney to the biggest markets in Canada and then to Australia, where there's another Sydney. Even though he's on the other side of the world, he's another familiar voice here on the coast. He does what we call imaging. You actually heard him already at the top of the program.
This is the Coast 89.7 Weekly News Magazine Dialogue.
Here's Ron right now, and we're going to talk about Australia being one of the safest places in the world. But first, Ron is going to talk about his love for radio.
So I started in radio in Cape Breton. I worked at the local radio stations. Grew up in Sydney, was born in Sydney, lived in Margaree for a little bit, but loved Cape Breton Island. Beautiful place, one of the most beautiful places in the world. But Cape Breton, and then I went off to Truro, Nova Scotia. Worked there a little bit, then off the C100 Halifax, had a great time in Halifax, ended up being the voice of ATV and doing some imaging as well along the way. And then the big leagues, Toronto called, and went off to Toronto and worked there for about 10 years or so before I came to Australia. And I came to Australia exactly 10 years ago now, right now. So it's like our 10th anniversary of living in Australia. Since I've been in Australia, I've been in radio as well, worked for Nova Entertainment, worked a little bit on the air here, but the funny thing is that, you know, when you come from North America and you work in Australia, the first thing they think, oh, you're American, and it just doesn't work here, being an American-sounding broadcaster. The local listeners just assumed, oh, it's being piped in from America, so he can't be from here. So I ended up working behind the scenes, and I continue to work behind the scenes, and I do overseas work in my home studio. So I still do all aspects of radio, but I had a great career kind of working all around the globe, let's face it.
So, Ron, you made your way to the big markets, major markets in Toronto and in Australia. Can you talk about what it's like working in the big markets, and how is it different than working in smaller communities? Is there more of a connection with the listeners in a place like Cape Breton?
Well, I think radio is constantly evolving in every level, but I do recall one of the best things, I think, the timing when I got into radio, which would have been the early 90s, definitely a lot more local content. And I think that continues for a lot of local, small, regional radio stations. But definitely that you know, meeting the personalities, getting out into the public, meeting the, you know, the most valued listeners that tune into the local radio station, that was always a joy for me, just getting out to meet people. And being on the radio with my peers, I think, like Phil and Bill and some of the guys you work with there, I really looked up to in my years growing up in Cape Breton. And it was a very proud moment for me to work alongside of those guys. I've got an insatiable appetite for radio. Grew up loving radio. I think since the age of 8 years old, I wanted to be on the radio. So, you know, I remember, you know, recording Phil and all the local personalities back when I was a kid and mimicking everything they said, talking to myself in my bedroom, trying to be, you know, the local personality and you know, to be able to get on the radio locally there. And then in major market radio, you know, I got into major market radio probably leading into the 2000s and then right through to 2011 in Toronto. And I think just, you know, living the dream for me, just being able to like you sit in the studio and chat with some of the big name celebrities that came through town and host an afternoon show in Toronto was just a dream come true, you know, just to be able to communicate on that level and to achieve every dream I possibly could have had as a broadcaster in the industry, you know, by working in the big leagues and being on a top rated radio station just felt amazing. So I guess just having that dream come true in my life. And one thing I did get to do when I was in Toronto, I did a lot of voice acting at some of the local agencies and did a lot of imaging work for more TV stations as I went along and different radio and TV projects along the way. I did a stint with Sirius Satellite Radio for a while, which was amazing. So I got to do everything and anything. And that's the best part about this industry. It'll take you pretty much anywhere you want to go.
So you would have seen some major changes in radio if you started working in the 90s. At that time, you're probably using grease pencils and razor blades to actually edit the tape. Now, of course, with the click of a mouse, you can cut the audio with digital software, but so much has changed. And how would you describe the difference? And how did those changes affect the way you do your job?
Yeah, it's funny. You know, a lot of people will ask me this question, and I do remember playing records, and I do remember playing, you know, when I first got my very early days, I was in high school, and I was working at the local radio station in Sydney there, and I remember playing 45s and records, but every time I entered into a brand new radio station, there was some big evolution or change. I remember we switched when I was at the local radio station in Sydney. They were just switching from 45s to CDs pretty much the day I walked in. And then later on when I moved on to Halifax and then into Toronto, I remember in Halifax when I arrived there, they were just switching from CDs to the new radio computing systems that kind of run everything today. All the, you know, they've got the auto, the satellite modes and the live assist mode that they have in these this new technology. So right up to today, I mean, I working here at Nova in Australia, I was the first one to hit the button for the new Zeta, which is one of the most advanced pieces of technology in the radio industry that's available now around the globe. So, yeah, it feels like it's a really good question, but there has been quite a big metamorphosis as I've moved along facing technology change. And maybe that's what makes me so able to make those transitions all through my life, was that I've always faced them the day one anywhere I kind of ever started in the radio industry. So it's been a very interesting ride, that's for sure. But definitely technologically, very advanced along the way.
So we're lucky here at the coast. We're able to maintain live on-air hours throughout the day, and it's unfortunate automation is reality for many stations. And so many people now, they have to get their news online from things like Facebook and Twitter.
Yeah, I think I think radio still has a trust value that that those mediums don't have. You know, I think anybody and everybody under the sun, under the moon, can write and say what they want on Facebook and online. But radio, there's still a trust value that goes along with it. And it's actual journalism that you're listening to when you tune into a local radio station. And I think there's a, I think radio, you know, with automation and that sort of thing kind of taking over in some groups, it's quite a disappointing thing, because radio, out of all mediums, in my opinion, rides the storm. I mean, back in the late 70s, early 80s, the song The Buggles' Video Killed the Radio Star came out, and everybody thought, oh, that's it, radio's done, video's taking over. But it actually just enhanced radio. The internet came along, you know, as a mainstay in the, I guess, late 90s and 2000s and so on. And everybody thought, well, the internet's going to dominate. No, it hasn't. It's enhanced radio. I mean, radio just kind of rides this storm that it faces time and time again, and primarily because people listen to radio in cars. It's the number one place that they tune into radio. So obviously, you know, the audience is still there. People still want local surveillance. They want local information, and they get it from their local radio stations.
And especially now, as something that connects people all over the world with the pandemic, there really is no better time to be able to get up-to-date information and accurate information because of COVID-19.
Yeah, absolutely. Listen, I think what we've noticed here, and I work in radio here, I work more programming and behind the scenes here in radio, and we've seen an increase from 5 to 8% in radio during the pandemic, because it's a comfort for people. The world is in array, and the number one thing you can rely on is the local personality, the local voice, the local news and information that you get, that surveillance that, you know, you don't take it for granted anymore. The same reason why people are more likely to shop local than ever before, because they realize now that with things like the pandemic, that everything's vulnerable. We don't want to lose what we have that we really do hold dear to our hearts, and we can't take for granted things that we really enjoy and love. For example, our local radio broadcast. And I think that's a big part of it.
So how are things going in Australia with COVID? It's a region doing very well in keeping the virus under control. The numbers are very low, and they have stayed very low, especially since last summer. And of course, we're dealing with the third wave here in Nova Scotia, and we've had the highest numbers since the pandemic started.
Well, listen, I only know from what I see on media or read, you know, or hear in mass media from around the globe, but I do realize that we're living in a bubble in Australia, and, you know, we have managed it very differently, I think. And I guess the biggest advantage that we have, geography. I mean, we're the furthest away from anywhere else in the world. I mean, it takes us 10 hours to get to, you know, Hawaii. It takes us, you know, I live as far as I possibly can away from where I grew up without going to outer space, you know. So I think geography is a big win for us. The ability to be able to shut down flights and to shut down people moving the virus via community to Australia is pretty much, you know, it's nil, which means that we win, you know. So when I read the news about, you know, what's happening in Nova Scotia right now, or what's happening, you know, around the globe, or Toronto, or anywhere, India, for example, it does feel like we live in a bubble here. We're actually, you know, we've managed this pandemic very well. We've been diligent in keeping our public safe. We've been a world leader, really, in containment and management of the pandemic, and there's no doubt about it. We've been great with the tracing, with the quarantine, the hotel quarantine, and just following this virus and nixing it any possible way we can. And listen, I can't even leave Australia right now unless I apply to leave. I can't. And then if I do leave, the chances of me getting back are almost just impossible. They've actually shut down all international flights. There are very few people, and I think it's just returning Australians that are coming back into the country at the moment. And that's going to continue. The government made an announcement here that that will continue at least until early 2022. Until this virus is completely under control around the world. We've got it under control here, but we do know that if we let the virus move into, you know, come to Australia freely, it's going to spread here like wildfire. And that's something that we just can't afford. So it's very much under control here. In fact, we've got zero cases across the country on most days at the moment. Any new cases that we do get in are returning Australians coming from other parts of the world, and it's under hotel quarantine. And that brings me to the hotel quarantine. From day one, Australia had a plan in place to stop it at the borders. We knew right away that, well, hey, if the virus isn't, you know, traveling via the community here right now, we've got it under control, Where is it coming from? Well, it's coming from overseas. Where is it ever once spot to stop that? The airports. So we've actually had, under military watch, any international flight mandatory quarantine, where we've, international travelers would come into the airports, and they would be escorted to the local hotels that would be the quarantine hotels, where they'd be practically under guard. I guess I'm making it sound a lot meaner than it really is, but just under guard to maintain that they're tested properly, and they're able to leave 14 days later, with a clean record of health into the community, and therefore eliminating the chance that the virus is actually going to move into Australia. So we've been very good at the hotel quarantine, mandatory, 100% mandatory, even from state to state. So even if I live in Queensland. I used to live in New South Wales, so we're very close here at the border. People traveling across the border would have to endure the 14-day quarantine as well. Right now, that doesn't exist. We're now free as a country. You can go anywhere you want. We've for quite a while. So we had a short stint of serious lockdown across Australia, but that's been eliminated because we've had no community transmissions. Now, in terms of the international flights, we still just don't have any international flights coming in. And if we do, they're very limited, and they're returning Australians, and they're still mandatory hotel quarantine. So we've got it under control in that aspect.
So the Chief Medical Officer of Health, Dr. Robert Strang, talks about the importance of watching out for one another and do whatever is possible to help people deal with the third wave. And basically, it's a very important ingredient, he says, with the pandemic measures that they've ordered. And do community leaders in Australia, do they also take that approach?
Absolutely. And one thing, I'm not sure if you've ever come to Australia or not, but there's a real sense of mateship here. I mean, that's, I guess, practically why I think Australians believe that they built friendships and they invented it. And that's a funny thing. I always find it funny because, I mean, I come from a very friendly Cape Breton Islands, one of the friendliest places on the planet, one of the nicest places and most beautiful. But there's a real sense of mateship here as well, where we look after each other. And, although the cities are big and Sydney is one of the biggest cities in Australia, it is the biggest next to Melbourne, and then you've got Brisbane, where I live right now. But just a real sense of people looking after each other. But yeah, the leaders, our leader, our premier, has been very, very, very much enforcing the fact you've got to look after each other. We've got to be on the same page. And like clockwork, when they announced, and we've had a few quick snap lockdowns where we did have to look out for ourselves and wear a mask for a weekend and not go anywhere and be in house arrest for 2 or 3 days. If you did have to go out for the, essentials, you'd notice very quickly, wow, people really adhere. And I was very surprised. I'm not sure if the same thing happens there. And I often question that, like, why is there so many cases? Do they have it under control? I guess, you'd only read what you see in media, mass media, and what you see in the news stories on the local TV. But other than that, yeah, we've adhered very much so to the local authorities.
So we've been chatting with Ron Young, a radio guy who started on the airwaves here in Cape Breton. He worked in some of the biggest markets in Canada, and now he's in Australia, a region considered a global leader in keeping the pandemic under control. Ron, thanks so much. It was really great to talk to you, and all the best to you.
My pleasure. Thank you so much, Bill. I appreciate your time.
Catch Dialogue 3 times weekly, Sundays at noon, Tuesday and Thursday at 10 p.m., Dialogue is a production of the Coast 89.7 News. For story suggestions, contact 902-849-9303 or email news@coastalradio.ca. For past episodes of Dialogue, check out our Dialogue podcast, available now online at coastalradio.ca.
That's all for Dialogue this week. Thanks for listening. I'm Bill McCush.